From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. A few weeks ago, an article in the New York Times Magazine by the journalist Maggie Jones raised some intriguing questions about what teenagers are learning from pornography. Because there isn't much research yet, Jones says we don't know any specifics on what young people actually watch or really how it translates into behavior. We can be pretty sure that most are watching it. And what also seems clear, even if only anecdotally right now, is that the images are confusing them. Jones writes, porn confounds many teenagers about the kinds of sex they want because they aren't always sure what's fake and what's real. Today in the program, we're discussing Jones' story, what we know and what we don't know yet, and how you're supposed to talk to kids about pornography in the first place. Join us after the news.
We want to take a moment to shout out The Good Line for supporting this podcast. If you're building a brand, these guys can help you with websites, film, design. They're all about finding and telling stories that bring together a full brand experience. Check out the new Radio West Films website to find out what that means, or you can see what else they do at thegoodline.com.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. The journalist Maggie Jones spent a year talking to older teenagers about pornography, what they saw, what they learned from it. One of the young men she talked to explained how young people make certain assumptions based on what they're seeing on screen. He told her, it gets in your head. If this girl wants it, then maybe the majority of girls want it. Jones' article was published in the New York Times Magazine a few weeks ago, and in it, she says the images in pornography can be confounding for teenagers. They're often confused about what's real and what isn't, and they're left with a more abstract idea of things like consent and intimacy. Today in the program, we're talking about Jones' article, about what young people may be learning from watching pornography. Though the article is also about how parents themselves are confounded by the idea of talking to their kids about all of this. I'll begin with a warning, which is probably obvious. We're talking about pornography, so the conversation could get candid, maybe even at times graphic, so it's probably not the kind of show for everyone. You can join us if you have comments or questions. Here are a few questions to think about. Where do you think that young people should be learning about pornography? Should they be taught about it? How did early exposure to pornography affect your own sexual life and experiences? Maggie Jones is a contributing writer for the New York Times Magazine. She also teaches in the MFA program at the University of Pittsburgh. Her article is called What Are Teenagers Learning from Online Porn? It appeared in the February 11th issue of the magazine. We'll put a link to it on our website. Maggie is joining us today from NPR member station WESA in Pittsburgh. That's where she's based. And Maggie Jones, thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me.
So I guess I wanted to begin. I know you've been thinking about this and researching this for a good time now. What got you started on the article? Thinking about what?
Well, I've reported a lot on teenagers and youth in general, youth at risk and immigrant youth. And I was actually talking to somebody here in Pittsburgh, Liz Miller, who is an adolescent medicine expert. And she told me about this class in Boston that was groundbreaking, teaching teens about porn literacy, that if they're going to watch porn, which not all the teens, it's not expected or required that they do, how they can think about it with a more critical lens.
Generally speaking, one of the things I mentioned in the introduction, you say in the piece that the images are confounding teenagers because they don't always get what's real and what's fake in porn. I guess here's the thing that interests me more than anything. It's one of the things that you mentioned in the piece is that it's difficult to make these causal connections yet, that we don't have a ton of research right now. So what can you learn from just having conversations with young people and can you draw conclusions from that?
Right. That is part of the struggle with this, is that we don't have good studies. It's very difficult to do really good studies that can show cause and effect, because you can't sit kids in front of pornography for several months and then track their sexual behaviors. That's not really ethical. So, you know, we have surveys where teens self-report how much they've seen porn, lessons they take from porn. And from interviewing dozens of teenagers, I did hear messages repeated. And I made sure, you know, I wasn't just talking to urban teenagers or I wasn't just talking to suburban teenagers. They'd had a variety of experience of having almost no sex education to some sex education. And the kinds of themes that kept emerging was, as you said at the beginning, that it felt very confounding to them, that that they understood that porn was on some level fake, like it wasn't necessarily a couple filming themselves having sex who were already a romantic couple. But they often expected that the female pleasure expressed in pornography was real, that they turned to it for sort of how-to lessons on sex, about sex. So it, you know, people talk about, oh, well, porn's fantasy, but not everybody completely understands that, especially when you haven't had the experience of having sex or having really good in-depth sex education.
Yeah. One of the teens that you talk to, you call him Drew in the piece. He said that from porn, he learned that guys need to be buff. They need to be dominant in bed. They learn that girls moan a lot and are turned on pretty much by everything a confident guy does. Talk a little bit about that, this idea that he even mentions that he had seen one particular video where a guy who was who had approached sex in a kind of gentle way was put off by the girl. She was more into the more aggressive guy. So talk a little bit about how he was, what he was seeing in that.
So when we're talking about mainstream online porn, which is not the only porn, there is feminist porn, there is LGBT porn, but the stuff that is free that teens can access is the mainstream sites that are very easy to get on. And the narratives, not 100%, but the narratives are pretty similar in that they're focused on male pleasure. You know, porn's, if you're talking about porn performers, they tend to have, you know, a certain kind of body type, the women and men. There's some variation. And the stories are very similar. Because they're focused on male pleasure, the sex can look fairly rough, aggressive. And again, when there's no other – maybe that doesn't matter when you're an adult and you've got real life experience. But for Drew and for other boys and girls I talked to, this felt like, okay, so this is how sex goes.
Yeah, yeah. Most of the heterosexual videos, for example, of this type are shot from so the male point of view. And the basic idea, the intent of is for the man to have an orgasm. Like that's the purpose, basically.
That's it. That's the focus. Yep. And that's, you know, that's a story as old as time. I mean, the pornography in that way hasn't changed that much.
Right.
But, you know, and one of the things that's interesting about female pleasure in a lot of mainstream porn is there's this sort of constant moaning, like every little single thing that's happening to her is pleasurable, but it doesn't really focus on the how-tos of pleasure. So you could easily be a teenager watching porn and not get a sense of how female pleasure really works, or assume that, you know, everything's pleasurable. Everything.
Yeah.
Because the women constantly seem like they're in a state of ecstasy.
It's interesting. One of the things you point out, as you said a moment ago, that there's not a lot of research yet on exactly what kids are looking for and what they're looking at. But you do mention one effort by Rashida Jones, the actor, to try and raise some money and do this national survey about porn viewing. And the survey that they did, I think, was interesting. It revealed a couple of things, and I wanted to mention some of this. Nearly 40% of the boys watched videos of men ejaculating on women's faces. Nearly 40%. More than a quarter watched so-called double penetration videos, You can imagine what that is. More than 30% watched so-called gangbangs or group sex or rough oral sex. So, I mean, that does seem to be, whether or not this was a conclusive study, that does seem that what they're watching and what they're seeing as sort of normalized is of a type, I guess.
Right. So that was a study of 614 teenagers ages 14 to 18. And in terms of what they'd seen, it was of those who had seen porn, and it was about half of them had seen porn.
Yeah.
And yeah, I mean, some of those things that you mentioned, I mean, I think a generation ago, there wasn't that kind of access to those images. And, you know, I want to say up front, there's nothing wrong with any particular sex act. It's just that boys, when they're seeing mainstream porn, are seeing a lot of obviously very explicit and often really aggressive sex. And yes, ideas like, you know, double penetration and BDSM, which is bondage, domination, sadism, masochism. It's fine if that's what somebody's into. It's just that lots of times teenagers are coming across something the first time, mm-hmm. going looking for it, not because that's necessarily what they desire, but they stumble upon it. And what's interesting is that parents from that same study, they interviewed both the teenagers and their parents. The parents underestimated what their teens were seeing. The fact that their teens were even seeing porn, half as many parents thought their teens were seeing porn,
right.
itself.
Yeah.
And then when they asked them about specific sex acts, they underestimated by as much as 10 times.
Mm. How do you explain that, by the way? I wonder if people have been able to explain that. Is this a technology gap that they can't imagine how incredibly accessible it is for young people, or that they just don't like to think of their young people as in, you know, as their kids thinking about this kind of thing? I mean, has anyone explained that parental, naivete gap that you write about?
Well, I think it's exactly what you say. I think it's a technology gap that specifically when you come to porn, I think lots of parents are not thinking about what porn looks like now and how easy it is to find. You know, a bunch of these sites are in the top 100 most trafficked websites in the world. So a lot of people, and I assume plenty of those parents, are watching porn, so they should know about what it looks like. But they may assume that they've got filters that are blocking out things, or they haven't seen it and don't know what it really looks like now. And I think the last thing that you mentioned of parents just not wanting to think that their kids are watching porn and really not wanting to have that conversation about pornography. So I think there's just a lot of parents who have blinders on about it.
Have most sites just basically given up on even attempting to keep young people from watching them? I mean, one of the things you point out in the piece is the mainstream sites aren't really doing all that much. I mean, they may be doing something technically, but not much to actually verify a person's age.
Right. You have to say you're 18. Most teenagers don't have a problem telling a little white lie. And, right, nobody's asking for you know, your driver's license or a credit card. It's free. So there are not a lot of roadblocks to accessing it. And, you know, the other thing is that you may not be going on the porn sites yourself, and you may have some, you know, extraordinary block techniques on your, you know, filter techniques on your home computer. But by teenage years, it's really hard for parents to have filters that kids don't have a workaround. And then, you know, it's on your friend's phone. It's at your friend's house. It's not there's just so much that parents can do to really filter this out. And I don't think that that's the entire answer to the problem.
Yeah.
Do we have a sense of when young people first encounter porn and whether that age is going down as they have more access?
Yes. I mean, it appears so, you know, with everything, I would say we need more studies. We don't have enough good studies. But there, about a decade ago, there's a study out of University of New Hampshire that the average age then was about 14 and 15. Girls typically are a year older than boys. It is now the recent study that came out of Indiana University, which, as you remember, as you mentioned, Rashida Jones, that's part of a study that she helped fundraise for. They found, these are preliminary results, that the average age for boys is 13 and for girls is 14, which suggests, and other studies suggest in Europe, that it's gotten younger, and a third of those who have seen it are under 12. There are, you will see citations of people saying, on average, you know, kids have seen it at age 9, or the majority of kids have seen it by 11. That's inaccurate.
So do we have an idea? I guess what interested me was, does easier access affect or alter the way young people would just naturally encounter porn? Like in the 70s or 80s when you had to find a stash of your friend's father's box in the attic. And now that it's so easier, does that – I mean, is there any sense – and again, it's probably – we don't have enough information yet, but whether it's sexualizing young people, I guess, at earlier ages?
So there are two things in that. One is, yeah, we don't have enough information. It seems intuitively correct that, right, they must be watching more porn. Yeah. I had a really hard time finding numbers, especially also you can't compare countries. It's very hard. So if you're looking at U.S. data, as I said, it looks like it's about a year younger than it was a decade or so ago. And in terms of sexualizing children, we really don't know. I mean, pregnancy rates are down, early sex rates are down. And one of the things I do caution in this story is I don't want people thinking that, you know, we should have a – you know, pearl-clutching moral panic about
right.
this. Kids aren't having sex at younger ages. They aren't there. And there may be a variety of reasons for that. I think the question is more about is pornography influencing the ways that boys and girls, when they are starting to have sex, is it creating a narrative that is created in the absence of good sex education?
Yeah. Well, that's the thing. This is the thing that's so complicated. It's hard, as you point out, to find a direct cause and effect. And it's kind of – it seems to me like it's the same kind of thing with trying to find a connection between violent behavior and violent video games. I mean, in many ways, if you look at the studies, there's not really a causal connection. But then there's that kind of knee-jerk hunch that it must be having some kind of impact on young people, that it must be, in the case of violent video games, it must be inuring them to violence, but there's no actual connection. So that seems to really complicate the way we look at all of this.
It does. And you know, it doesn't have to be – for us to be concerned, we don't have to think, okay, right, you see a porn video and then you go out – you know, it's a violent video, which I want to speak to that as well because I'll come back to that. But you don't have to go see some porn act and go the next day and replicate it. And violence isn't the same as sort of not understanding about communication and that you need to ask and that you need to learn about consent and that you need to understand that those expression of pleasure on the women's behalf aren't necessarily how it translates into real life. The thing I want to say about violence in porn, you know, when we're talking about sort of extreme violence, that is not the common narrative. There's a lot of aggression in porn. Studies show that somewhere between 33% and around 80% show some form of aggression, slapping, spanking, name calling. That extreme violence is a much smaller proportion. And I would also say that a kid who watches pornography on and off is very different than a kid who goes online 10 times a day looking for violent porn.
What did you learn about whether young women in sexual situations feel like they have much of a choice, whether they lack, as you explained it in the piece, sexual agency? Because this seemed to be something that some of the girls told you, for example, that they did not want their partners ejaculating on their faces, but they figured this was just one of the things they had to do now.
Yeah, and that's a really interesting issue because, you know, none of these sex acts were invented by porn, and they probably – everything's been around for a long time in some form. But that narrative does seem to be on the rise, and we don't have longitudinal data, but there's – from that same Indiana University study, you know, it was about a sixth of boys who had had sex said that they had ejaculated on a partner's face, which seems pretty surprising, I think, to people who grew up in the 70s or 80s. And I think the issue about sexual agency, sadly, is not new. I think what's happened, at least from my interviews and some suggestions from some studies about anal sex too, is that the menu has gotten bigger. And so there's a lot of talk, even if tons of teenagers aren't having anal sex, there's a lot of talk about it. There's a study out of England about how boys both – there was influence of pornography and the influence of feeling competitive with one another and to have anal sex. And the girls are supposed to sort of bear it and that pain was to be expected. So there becomes this narrative for lots of teenagers about – sort of rough sex is more normative. And it doesn't mean that all these girls are being coerced or forced into rough sex, but it's certainly part of the conversation. And, you know, I have to say it is disheartening as a feminist, after all these decades of being a feminist, to hear how many girls feel like, you know, as one girl says in the story, you got to do what you got to do. That's not a true across the board. There's another girl in the story who really came to own her sexual agency. And certainly there are teenage girls like that. But pornography, let's say, certainly doesn't help that narrative of creating female sexual agency.
When we come back from a break, Maggie wanted to talk about this high school course that you profile in the piece. It's known as a porn literacy created by Emily Rothman, associate professor at Boston University's School of Public Health. And we're going to bring her on here in a moment. Give us a sense of what's the idea? As you put it in the piece, it's about making young people, and I'll quote you here, more critical consumers of porn, basically.
Right. The idea is it's an after-school program. And the idea is whether or not you've seen porn, you're probably going to come across it. Statistics bear that out. There's no porn shown in the class, but if you see porn, you should be aware, like with any media, of the stereotypes in porn, the power dynamics in porn, the gender stereotypes, the racist stereotypes, the heteronormative stereotypes. And so with the concept is if you're going to watch porn, think about it in terms of your own values. Think about it in terms of what your values are around intimacy, and have just sort of a savvier take on what you're consuming.
Maggie Jones is with us. She's a contributing writer for the New York Times Magazine. Her article, What Are Teenagers Learning from Online Porn?, appeared in the February 11th issue. We have a link to it on our website, radiowest.org. We'll take a break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're discussing what it is young people learn from online porn. And for a moment, put aside whether they should be watching porn or whether porn is wrong or porn is bad. The fact is, a lot of teenagers just are looking. And so In a recent story for the New York Times Magazine, the journalist Maggie Jones explored the effect that porn may be having on the way kids think about gender and intimacy and consent, not to mention their actual sexual behavior. Maggie Jones is a contributing writer for the New York Times Magazine. She's joining us from Pittsburgh, where she's based, and she's going to stay with us here. Also joining us now on the program is Dr. Emily Rothman, who is an associate professor in the Department of Community Health Sciences at the Boston University School of Public Health, director of the Rothman Violence Prevention Lab, and she developed this pornography literacy course that we've talked about. And Emily Rothman is joining us from a studio in Boston. And Dr. Rothman, welcome to you. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks so much for having me.
I wanted to start, Dr. Rothman, with about a finding that you saw back in 2011, because you've talked about how this seems to be when your own interest in this subject really sort of kicked in. And it was a study about dating violence. Could talk a little bit about how you started thinking about all of this.
Yeah, so I never did set out to be a pornography researcher or think about developing education around it at all. I've been trained to work as a domestic violence and dating violence researcher, and I had data to look at that were from victims of dating abuse. What surprised me is that in that study, we had asked just one question about pornography. It was, has your partner ever asked you to do something that he first saw in pornography? And a surprisingly large percentage of the kids had had that experience. I think it was around 30%. And then it was even larger among those who were dating violence victims. And in fact, it was one of the strongest associations that we saw in that whole study where we were trying to figure out what's happening for kids related to dating violence. So right there, I thought to myself, huh, pornography, that's not something I've actually really considered so far. And maybe that's worth looking into a little more.
11% said they'd been forced or coerced into participating in sex that the perpetrator saw in pornography. Is that a significant number, 11%? That seems high.
Yeah, I mean, I think it is a substantial percent. It was certainly a lot more than we expected going into it.
So talk about how the course began. It came from your interest in all of this, and that you noticed that kids were, asking a lot of questions, I guess, about pornography.
The way it got started was I had always worked closely with my colleagues at the Boston Public Health Commission, who run a program called Start Strong, which is for dating violence prevention. And so Nicole Daly and Jess Alder running that program, and they would always have me over just to talk a little bit about my work to get kids interested in research. And so I would always come over and say a little something about dating violence. Well, this one day, of course, I had been working on this pornography variable in this one study. And so I started talking about that, and the room sort of blew up with conversation. You know, all of a sudden kids sat up. They wanted to know more about that. They were just really interested. And so I think Nicole and Jess and I all looked at each other and thought, huh, maybe we should go with the flow on this one, since what we're trying to get them to do is think about how they treat each other in relationships and sexual consent and respect and boundaries. But there's this natural vehicle for doing it. They're really excited to talk about this one topic, and we see how we can make use of that to get that conversation going. That's when something fell into place for us that, well, maybe we can really harness this and do something with it.
Why do you think they're excited? Is it because they want to know? A part of it, I guess, is just basic titillation, I suppose. But how much of this is also curiosity and just lack of knowledge?
Yeah, so I think it was just the novelty of grown-ups not ever having talked about something like that straightforwardly with them before. And, you know, just being in a room where we're allowed to say the word. So a lot of it was that. And then just that they had so few other opportunities to have their very reasonable questions answered about pornography or talk about it with people who were willing to give them sort of direct information.
Why do teenagers watch porn? Which is like the most obvious question ever, but it seems like the answer is kind of complicated.
Well, you know, so there's a couple different ways to think about this question. First of all, of course, there's lots of different kinds of sexually explicit media. So it's not all porn is created equal. So when we're answering this question, like why do kids watch porn, we have to also think about what kind of sexually explicit media exactly are we talking about. Yeah. And you can also think, well, it's hard to generalize to all kids because different people are motivated by different things. That said, I can tell you that the research that exists suggests that the number one reason that adolescents, just like adults, seek out sexually explicit media is for sexual excitement.
Yeah.
But there are other reasons that fall into that number two, number three, number four slot. Some of those are boredom. Some of those are curiosity. And one of the big ones, at least from the research that I've been working on, is education. I want to know how to have sex. I want to know what I'm supposed to do. And given the lack of access to comprehensive sex education, it's sort of reasonable that that's one of the places where they're trying to turn to get that information.
Maggie Jones, this is one of the things you point out in your piece, that there's this paradox about sex and pornography in this country, that, you know, digital technology has made it easier for teenagers to have access to porn. But sex education in the United States is still really limited.
Yes. 26 states don't mandate sex education at all, and only 13 states in the country actually require that the material be medically and scientifically accurate. So the most sort of comprehensive, detailed sex education tends to be in private schools, some innovative community programs. The Unitarian Church has a great program, but it's, you know, it's very piecemeal. So lots of kids are denied really very basic sexual information.
You say in your piece that even teachers in Oregon, which is pretty liberal in terms of its sex ed approach in some ways, teachers in Oregon were reluctant about how you're supposed to deal with the question of pornography.
Yeah, Oregon is one of the best states for comprehensive sex education, and an educator there wrote a curriculum to teach about sexually explicit media, and it hasn't been used in any of the schools. And part of the reason is the teachers are scared. It's really hard to talk about sex in schools in explicit ways, but I think the conversation about pornography, we're even more behind on that. And again, that goes back a little bit to that lots of adults don't actually understand the landscape that teenagers may be seeing. And that, you know, here we are, the country that's the biggest producer of porn, but it is not a conversation. I found in reporting this story and talking to lots of adults who, you know, weren't experts in this story, but just friends and colleagues about this, it became really clear to me how much fear or anxiety there is about talking about pornography.
Emily Rothman, why do you think it is that, as Maggie points out in her piece, that there's no one quite knows yet just what the best practices are? Why isn't there a clear idea of what's effective? Is it just because we're in early days or we haven't really attended to it yet?
Well, yeah, I mean, so just to be clear, this isn't a class that we were able to test out or try in any public school or any private school. We didn't even attempt to talk to school boards or superintendents to get permission to do that. It was part of an after-school program that kids from the city of Boston could choose to go to.
Yeah. They had to opt in, I guess, probably.
Yeah,
right?
opt in, and yep. Nobody had to go to it, and their parents opted them in and all of that. But the reason is because it's a touchy subject. It's difficult even to provide just basic, factual, comprehensive sex education in any classroom environment. And so the idea that we would in any way try to take on something that had this like little extra, you know, level of intrigue to it was beyond the pale. We knew that we weren't going to be able to do that. At the same time, it was so hard to just sit there and look at the kids literally like jumping out of their seat, wanting to talk about this, having questions, us seeing the direct connection to the topic that we're trying to educate people about, which is healthy relationships, healthy boundaries and safety and respect. And so, how could we not provide them a forum for having some of these discussions?
One of the things that Maggie points out in the piece is that the curriculum for this particular after-school program is not designed to suggest that porn is going to ruin their lives or, I think as she puts it, warp their libidos, or even that it's necessarily addicting. Would you talk a little bit about that idea, that you have to kind of strike a balance here? So I guess that question of shame and that question of whether it's going to destroy your life and engulf you, how do you take that on?
Yeah, that's a great question. And I'll sort of start just by getting the whole addiction question out of the way, because that's one that people can feel really strongly about. It's not a matter of semantics when we say, is porn addictive versus can porn become a compulsive behavior for some people? So whether pornography is biologically addicting is not something that the scientific community is in agreement about, though there are people who suggest that it is. But I think everyone is in agreement that just like anything else in life, some people do become compulsive users or problematic users. So, but just that sort of illustrates that, at least for me, I did try to take a very straight ahead social science perspective to the information that we're passing on to the kids. And so when there are mixed results around certain questions or ideas, whether it's addiction or something else, we tried to say, look, there's evidence on both sides, or here's what we know, here's what we still don't know, and try to present it to them like that.
I wanted to ask you about something. There was a here in Utah last year, researchers at Brigham Young University published this study about the connection between how religious someone is and their use of pornography. And the part of that I wanted to ask you about is one of the things they found is that they wanted to know basically how being religious affects the way you think about your own porn use. And what they found is that the more religious a person was, the more they tended to think that they were addicted to porn, even though they might not be technically addicted, and probably in most of those cases weren't, but that they thought that they were. What do you make of that?
Yeah, I mean, so it's a really interesting question, and I think it comes back to what is our relationship to pornography, and that it isn't going to be the same across the board for all people. So your relationship to pornography and how it affects you and then how it translates into your subsequent behavior with a partner, for example, gets filtered by a whole array of things. And one could be religion, but one could also be, you know, peers around you, what they're saying and doing, your family context, the environmental context, things that you've read. So this is why, for me anyway, it's very hard to get into conversations that either say all porn is bad for all people at all times, or the opposite, which is no, porn is just fine. There's no connection to anything bad. Neither of those are right. Neither of those are true. And part of the reason for that is because it matters who you are. Religious or other characteristics can influence how that porn basically gets into your brain, what happens to it inside there, and then what it does to your behavior and your feelings about yourself.
Hmm. It did make me wonder, though, if this was kind of an American thing. In some way, one of the things that, Maggie, you've written about this, there's this program in Australia and New Zealand called In the Picture I guess the point is there are other countries taking this on in more open ways than we've managed to figure out yet in the United States. And I'm wondering if this is just a cultural thing that we're kind of prudish and conservative in this state, in this country, about talking about those kinds of things, that it's different in other countries. Or is everyone freaked out about all of this?
Well, I think the Australian researcher, Marie Krabbe, was one of the first things she said to me when I talked to her, you know, sort of the paradox of being the world's largest producer of porn and among the largest consumers of porn, and yet, you know, we're incredibly scared of talking about sex in any explicit way. And, you know, there are other countries that are better about this. Australia and New Zealand have taken that program in the picture. It's Time We Talked. .com, I believe, and it is in some schools. There's a parent component to it, so it is more widespread than certainly the porn literacy program in Boston is at this time. But I do think, and I think Nordic countries are wrestling with this too. I found very few countries that really were addressing porn literacy at the high school level. I think lots of people want to. I talked to a Swedish researcher who was saying, you know, we need to wrestle with this. We need to talk about this and do something about it, but we really haven't done a good job so far. So I think it's universal in lots of ways. There may be countries that are more or less open about talking about sex and pornography, but there's certainly no country that has, that I could find, that has, you know, this is a mandated part of a K-12 curriculum.
Dr. Rothman, what do you think about that?
Yeah, I mean, I think that it could matter. The cultural context could temper things slightly. There's been a bunch of this research about the longitudinal impact of pornography, you know, at one moment in time and then following kids forward. A lot of it has come from the Netherlands. The results are consistent and I think apply here. So I think it's true that there are many different places that are all struggling with this same question. And, you know, thinking back to your other question about, like, are we at the beginning or where is this going to go next for all of us? It probably really depends if we're able to get funding that allows us to evaluate this type of literacy class to figure out if it's effective, because we don't want to put resources into it if it's not effective. And thinking about, are there constructive ways to bring in other pieces around it as well, whether that's reaching out to parents or providing other resources in a way that allow people to continue doing this kind of learning. And those things may need to look slightly different based on the cultural context or where they take place geographically.
That's Emily Rothman, an associate professor in the Department of Community Health Sciences at the Boston University School of Public Health. She's the director of the Rothman Violence Prevention Lab, developed this pornography literacy course for high school students that's featured in Maggie Jones' article in the New York Times Magazine. That, by the way, we'll put links to all of this on our website, radiowest.org. Maggie Jones is a contributing writer for the New York Times Magazine. She's joining us from Pittsburgh. Emily Rothman is joining us from a studio in Boston. And we need to take another break. So we'll do that and come back in just a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're discussing just what it is young people may be learning from online pornography. We have Maggie Jones with us, who's a contributing writer for the New York Times Magazine. She wrote a piece in the magazine a few weeks ago. It's getting a lot of people talking about all of this. We also have Dr. Emily Rothman with us, who's an associate professor at the Boston University School of Public Health, developed this pornography literacy course for teenagers there, and we're talking about all of this. Here's a comment from Heather, who writes from Salt Lake City. Some girlfriends and I, all moms of boys, she writes, have shared this article and had great discussions about it. Communicating, she writes, to our boys is a different story, though. They are not opening up to us when we've attempted to discuss all of this. And so she's asking, who can speak to them with authority but on their level and encourage them to contribute to this conversation? Dr. Rothman, what do you think? That's a tough one.
It's a great question, but I am so glad that somebody asked it, because I'm asked that often, like, you know, what can parents say? What can they do? And I say right back, do you like talking about pornography with your parents? Just like think about that for a second. I don't know that parents are necessarily the number one right people to be. And it's hard because as a parent, you want to be the one and you think. But when it comes to sex and sexuality, there's actually evidence that your teenager, as much as you love them and they love you, are not necessarily telling you everything when it comes to their sex life. And frankly, do you tell your parents everything about your sex life, or did you?
Yeah.
When you, it may not be appropriate to expect or ask the parents to take on this role. That is why, you know, we're fortunate in this country to have sex educators who are trained, who are part of professional association, who are ready to provide this kind of education. And they do have sort of the right attitude, the right relationship often. You know, I'm in awe of my colleagues, Nicole Daly and Jess Alder, because they're able to have such an easy flow with the kids. And I think that's important. And I just honestly don't see parents being able to pull off exactly that same thing.
There's a here's a question from Jeremy, who's wondering, is there anything in the pornography landscape that shows, quote unquote, right or conventional ways of sexual interaction And this kind of gets to something, Maggie Jones, that you write about in your piece. There's this porn education website, The Porn Conversation, started by this feminist porn producer, Erica Lust, is the name she goes by. And she, as you say, she takes it kind of a step further. She believes that parents of older teenagers should be talking to their kids about quote-unquote healthy porn. Would you talk a little bit about that, that as opposed to just saying, you know, porn has these certain, you know, tropes to it, there's some good stuff that you should maybe be looking at.
Right. How many parents, going back to Emily's comment, how many parents are really going to steer their kids
exactly
toward those quote-unquote good porn sites? I don't know. But she actually has, and she has suggestions for parents. Her website is aimed at parents for talking to children at different ages. And I agree with Emily, you know, once you get into the teenage years, really hard. But you can say, you know, there are certain things you can slip into conversations about, you know, that this isn't a representation of how lots of people like having sex, or that the body types aren't, you know, all people's body types, things like that. I think it's much easier when kids are younger. But yeah, so, you know, there are different types of pornography. They are not all created the same. And there are feminist pornography sites and ethical pornography sites. They tend to cost money. Yeah. Good porn tends to cost something. And so, you know, what good porn means is ethically produced, fair working conditions, a focus that includes women's pleasure, mutual pleasure. There are LGBT sites that, you know, show LGBT porn that and sex that is a better representation than you might find on some of the mainstream sites. So it's out there. I mean, you know, some people would say there's no such thing as good porn. I'm not in that camp. Yeah. I do think the idea that, yes, certainly you can talk to you don't have to know what those sites are or go to those sites to talk about what good representations of sex look like. It doesn't have to even be in terms of pornography. When and how you get those conversations in isn't the easiest thing as a parent.
Yeah, yeah. I wanted to ask both of you about, there's this, a few days after your story, Maggie, the New York Times columnist Ross Douthat wrote a piece where he raised the question of whether pornography should be, I mean, as the headline put it, whether it should be banned. But he was getting at something like regulation, and I wanted to get you to respond to a few of his points. He mentioned that we're in the midst of what he called this great sexual reassessment, a clearing out of assumptions that serve misogyny, put it, and impose bad sex on semi-willing women. And Douthat said that the assessment really wouldn't be complete if it doesn't reconsider this surrender, as he put it, to this idea that teenagers are just going to look at porn, so there's nothing we can do about it. What did you make of that idea of that now we should go for the regulation route and not give in to the idea that teens are just going to find this stuff?
So on my end, I would say, I mean, he does talk about banning pornography.
Yeah.
I think that's not only unrealistic. You can drive pornography underground, which isn't going to help with working conditions or anything like that. It typically only makes things worse. And I think the focus, you know, he doesn't really talk about sex education in that piece.
Yeah,
I think the focus on sort of, you know, the quote-unquote evils of porn by itself misses the bigger picture. And kids are going to find porn. They've always found porn.
Yep.
You can make it harder, and you know there can certainly be a debate about are there certain things you should do about creating more barriers for kids under 18. But I think his column really misses the key point that pornography can still exist and have a lot less potency if kids really understand sexuality and the variety of sexual behaviors and the fluidity of sexuality and all of that much better.
Yeah. Emily Rothman, I wanted to get you on that. And I'll just mention that here in Utah, of course, we passed this resolution back in 2016, which the governor signed, declaring pornography a public health crisis. So throw that into the mix and give me your sense of that, because you've said there are issues here, but it's not a crisis.
Yeah, I'm very careful about using the word crisis because being a public health expert and advocate, I'm aware that we always have to prioritize numerous different issues. And I don't want to burn people out on the idea that there's a crisis when we need them to take quick behavior on something that is going to have an acute effect on, deaths and lives immediately.
Yeah.
So the word crisis is a little troublesome for me. But this is a perfect public health question, actually, because our approach in public health is not to do an either or. We're saying you don't have to choose. You don't have to just make it about regulation. You don't have to just make it about educating people to have literacy. It's not an either or. You can go at this problem in multiple different ways, just like we do any other public health problem. You try to legislate and regulate things that are bad for people and also do some behavioral education with them to change them. So I think it can be both. The other thing that I would say, though, about this idea of a ban is there have been sexually explicit artworks since the beginning of time, really. And so if we start getting into this idea of we're going to ban everything that's sexually explicit, we're going to be going into a lot of museums, a lot of places, and having to now determine what actually counts as pornography and what doesn't.
It's Dr. Emily Rothman, an associate professor at the Boston University School of Public Health, joined us from a studio in Boston. Emily Rothman, thank you very much for the time.
Thank you. And I'd like to say Tiffany Christensen from Utah was my number one RA on this project.
Great. I'm glad you did. And Maggie Jones, her article, What Are Teenagers Learning from Online Porn, appeared in the New York Times Magazine. We have a link to it on our website. She joined us from Pittsburgh. Maggie, thanks to you.
Thank you so much. I enjoyed it.
Radio West, a production of KUER News. The program was directed by Tim Slover, produced by Claire Jones, Elaine Clark, and Benjamin Bombard. I'm Doug Fabrizio.